And now, Icon Art Radio.
Hi, it's Bill Teeple and Donna Colby and Alan Cobb, and this is Icon Art Radio. Today, we have selected the subject of how artists are influenced by others. That can be others sitting next to you in the art class. It could be your art teacher. It could be the art world heavyweights that whose work sits in the art magazines that we read every month and get all confused about. It could be the museum, the art of our former artists that are no longer with us, whose art sits on the walls of the museum. We're influenced by all of this. Now, you could stay in the cave and just make marks on the wall and not come out, and that saves the trouble of dealing with this subject, but pretty much we can't avoid it. So who's got something to say on this subject?
Well, I've got quite a few thoughts on this one. I mean, for me, the influence of other artists in my area is very, very strong. You know, some people respond to critics. I respond to other artists, not necessarily their reaction to what I'm doing, but my reaction to what they're doing. And the prime example of it, as sort of a minor tragedy in the history of my exploration of music, was in the 60s when Walter Carlos came out with Switched on Bach, which was really the first, accessible album of electronic music. It was also among the first electronic music productions that wasn't also experimental music. So it was electronic but non-experimental in the musical domain. And, I had been struggling with sort of homemade synthesis. You couldn't buy synthesizers in those days unless you were independently wealthy. A Moog synthesizer of any consequence, you know, was $100,000 and up. And other than that, you know, you could get strange electronic experimenter kinds of equipment and hook it together. And I was doing a little of that, but I didn't even have money for that. So mostly I was borrowing people's living room Lowry organs and, you know, secretly making changes to them under the lid and recording and then hopefully changing them back without leaving any permanent damage. And I was trying to do multi-track recording, but you couldn't get a multi-track recorder then unless you could afford, you know, a $75,000 rack mount machine and a recording studio. So I was doing, you know, sound on sound and bouncing tracks on a simple stereo recorder and eking out this material that was totally fascinating to me, but I was also not an accomplished musician. And Switched on Bach appeared on the scene, and here we had a guy who was a friend of Bob Moog and had probably a $500,000 Moog synthesizer installation in his home, not in some studio across the town, and a friend who was essentially a recording engineer, and he was also an accomplished Baroque keyboard player. And he just blew me and all of my experimenting friends right off the map. I mean, we heard Switched on Bach and we thought, okay, can't compete with that. And it was this sort of instant sense of, not that we had thought we were competing with anybody, but that with this, it was so far beyond anything that we could even begin to do, that it was absolutely discouraging. And we enjoyed the music, and we stopped making our own. Now, I say we. I don't know how many other people had that experience. But I almost stopped cold after I heard that. And I forced myself to continue working, but I knew that, you know, I wasn't going to be able. Now I knew what was possible, and I knew that my pigments didn't have those colors, and there was no way I was going to get close to what I wanted to do until the technology came to me.
But, you know, this is the experience that we all are familiar with just by going to the museum. Because in our little experimentations as artists and our attempts to have some control over skill and the craftsmanship, we do what we do and we think we have these great ideas and we're on our way somewhere. And then you go to the high museum and you look at the walls and you see that all these guys have already been there, and they've not only done it, I mean, they've done it way beyond what you could even imagine being wonderful. And you think, these are gods. We're in the presence of gods who have walked before us, and what's the use? So basically, you're expressing the thing we all know, the what's the use experience.
If you know that you're not going to be a Michelangelo, then
The other hand, that goes hand in hand with an experience. I sort of fluctuate between these two things when I'm in a museum. The thing of what I just described, and you realize this was just a guy like me doing what I'm doing, kind of working things out with his friends, and he did it this way and this way and this way. Now, I can go home, and I can do it this way and this way and this way too. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, I've become he's become my sort of friend and companion and guide, and there's actually, I can see how, there's hope for me. I can actually do that. Yeah. So you got this dual thing that goes on.
Well, because why do you do art? You know, I mean, that was the question that it's, are we doing art just to come up with something that nobody else has ever done before? Or are we doing art because of our own particular search for truth in art, you know, or what we want to express? And when I go to a museum, it acts as a reassurance to me, like a catalyst, because, I can look at a painting by Picasso where one line is like so brilliant and so perfect and bold, and I know that I'm not capable probably of making that line in my entire lifetime. But at the same time, I get such a wave of inspiration that kind of daring and vitality is possible in art. And that's what I get out of it. And I feel like going home and making my lines, whatever they happen to be, with that same kind of energy and boldness. And I think you can go either way, depending on your mood, even.
It kind of, how you enter the museum. Like, yeah, exactly.
and also there's this, you know, dimension of personal growth where being overshadowed by someone else who's better than you are is something you just have to live with. And after a while, you know, you get past it because you're always going to find somebody who's better than you are. And, you know, maybe not if you're Mozart, but then he didn't live very long. So, you know, it's a lesson that maybe comes up in a very obvious way in terms of art, but it's a lesson everybody has to contend with, whether they're, you know, being creative or just trying to learn to do their job, you know, effectively.
And everybody's original anyway, I think.
Oh, sure.
Even if they have directly become inspired by some art problem they read about in a book that Cézanne or somebody was working on, and they certainly can't paint it as well as Cézanne, and they don't want to spend a year on one painting like he may have done. But at the same time, just the concept that, oh, he worked in these layers, and he was playing with space in this way, and so you start thinking differently by studying the problems that these artists worked on, and maybe you decide, I'm going to work on that same problem. I've done this myself, where I've set up a still life or something like that to work on a certain problem I read about in a book about some great artist. And I'll start working on it, and then it'll take off into a completely different, unexpected direction far from that intention, and I don't think of that as a failure, but something that happened within me. It started out with that seed idea, and then something inside me
took
it in a different direction. And so
it's coming from you, and that's what makes it valid to produce your art. I mean, not only was Picasso probably at some stage in his life not completely confident about what he was doing and not absolutely sure that the direction he was going in was going to work and stuff, but also, when a child paints a painting, you respond to it as an expression of that person. You don't respond to it on some kind of absolute scale of painting or painterly skill or whatever. It's just that, look what he did. Isn't that cool? And to some extent, it's cool because it was done by a kid. To another, in a more sort of larger sense, it's interesting because it was done by an individual. And so, a person who doesn't have good drawing skills, who likes to draw and does a lot of, drawings that are technically, inept renderings, they may still reveal something spectacularly interesting and utterly, important and valid as fine art, or they may just be a wonderful expression of an individual, and anybody who knows him sees them, and he doesn't get famous, and it's never in a gallery, and it doesn't matter, but he's enjoying himself doing it, and he's learning from the process. I mean, look at the cartoonists who really, some of the cartoonists I know actually can't draw. They're terrible at drawing, and they do the most incredibly successful cartoons because not being able to draw in the sense of rendering accurately has nothing to do with being able to express yourself with lines on paper.
Roz Chast people are like that.
Yeah,
there are all these funny little people that just, and you just love them.
Yeah.
Somehow.
So this has to do with maintaining some kind of original innocence, like your original idea. Because like a lot of people make little cartoons that are really cool when they're young, and that they express an idea, a political idea, or some kind of caricature, or some emotional thing. They're very good at that. Only somewhere along the line, they're taught that brings up an interesting point, that that's not real serious art. And so they then launch off into trying to find serious art somewhere. And this innocent thing that came from their heart and was very natural for them gets lost. This is one of my particular concerns as a teacher, that this not get lost.
Yeah.
So it brings up, you said there isn't really a hierarchy of right and wrong necessarily, that it's all personal expression, but there is hanging over us as artists some kind of a concept of a hierarchy. And if your companion sitting next to you in the art class looks over and says, no, that's not how you do it. And I can't imagine that you put those colors together. What were you thinking?
Yeah, God, you still can't draw a face?
Right. And then if the teacher does that, and then if the art magazines and the critics are all doing that, and you get that wave after wave onto you, what does it do to your soul as an artist?
Well, I subscribed to Art in America last year. I resubscribed after a long hiatus. And I got a year's worth of those magazines, and I flipped every page, and I saw all the ads, and I saw the art. And there were some good articles, but it's sort of ironic to be buying a book of visual art because you prefer to read the articles. But anyway, I was utterly just grossed out, I think would be the simplest way of putting it, by that magazine. It was just such an onslaught of, people with greater or lesser graphical skills just scrambling, at the speed of sound all over each other, trying to outdo each other and get more visibility and make their mark and be recognized. And it's, forgetting the realities of the, the high-end art world and the gallery scene in New York and that kind of thing. Just looking at the images, it was like, taking an entire, artist's studio full of paint and just dumping all the paint on the floor and rolling around in it was the feeling I got from it. It wasn't inspired. I mean, I got no inspiration from it, and it was just because it was too much. It was way too much. It was like a completely disorganized gallery with no curatorial integrity of any kind, no message, no consistency, and you know, so in a sense, what that's saying is that the art scene in that context of, you know, what gets into art in America is a big mess. It has no theme. It has no direction. It's just a...
you're describing the postmodern art world quite well. and the power of these magazines. These magazines have controlled, and the critics that write for those magazines have in many ways controlled the education of the young art student in the last 40 years, particularly in the last, since the 60s. Mm-hmm. The art magazines have had huge influence. Yeah. I mean, personally, it changed my whole direction when I suddenly realized, my little world is not what it's about. This grand art world that is being described to me in art form and in Art in America and Studio International and all these magazines and these critics who all have PhDs in philosophy and linguistics are telling me, are making me feel how, this is worse than going to the museum and feeling like you can't paint. The magazines, which are all verbal and left brain, are telling me that I'm not an expanded and intelligent enough of an artist to even think about continuing.
Yeah,
but I'm so hooked into it and attached and in love with art, I have to keep groping towards the heights somehow.
Yeah,
and I'm hoping they will help me get there. And you really lose yourself this way.
Yeah.
Do you have to grope toward the heights in time, in your own time? Because that's another pressure I think we feel, is that we have to be ultra contemporary. And I actually stay 100 years behind the times on purpose, because the people who inspire me in the museums or in art books are still Picasso, Matisse, Cezanne. And a lot of the, even though, they made their breakthroughs, they made their statement, what they discovered was old hat in the art world, according to experts. But for me, in my own particular efforts and search in the visual process, that's what works. It's totally valid for me to look at what they did. It's not like I'm working on exactly what they were working on, but reading about their methods and reading about their lifestyle is inspiring to me. Or like that movie you showed about Calder, Alexander Calder. I mean, talk about eliminating pressure. Watching that movie of how
he was
so playful and joyful in his creative process. And to me, looking at him and what he did can lead to something ultra contemporary, because what you're looking at is a certain attitude towards art. That if I went into my studio with the same kind of attitude he had of, let's see what I've got here and let's see how I can put it together and make something fun, you know?
Yeah, no, Alexander Calder is the man.
Yeah.
That has demonstrated to all of us, including the highfalutin, snotty, whatever group all around him, that were so serious about their art and what they were doing. And he just, he wouldn't even call what he did art, because he didn't want to have to justify it as art.
Yeah.
He just wanted to do this stuff. And it was so rich and valid, truly valid, that all the great artists around him, Moreau and all of them, Picasso and the whole gang, loved him, loved his art, loved to come to his events, which included his little toy circus. I mean, what serious artist would still be playing with little toy figures and make a little circus? And yet he delighted those guys. And not only did he make the most delightful, playful little toy circuses with little acrobats. You know, he'd wind little, turn little cranks and stuff, and little acrobats would flip, and it was just so cool and so innocent and so simple and so fun. And at the same time, he would make sculptures that not only rivaled, but in fact, I think excelled the work of the great artists around him. And so he was like, he's the perfect example of how to stay with your heart and stay with your innocence and not lose it. And yet he was, the scary thing is that someone like Calder is so rare. Mm-hmm. It takes an incredible, like, simple integrity to be able to achieve that. And yeah. We have this trouble with simple integrity.
Well, that series that you've been showing at Paradiso of, you know, art in the 21st century, I'm always impressed by how few of those artists seem to be doing anything that's meaningful to themselves. You know, there's always a few who are just doing it because they love it and they're getting somewhere. And I'm much more interested in what they are doing and what they have to say through their art or just out loud. If I get the feeling that they are trying to get somewhere. But, I mean, there was one woman who was painting a star field. It was a black board she was painting on with little white spots. And the whole time she was talking about it, she talked about how much she disliked what she was doing and how tiring it was and how she'd been working on this one panel for a year and a half. And every now and then she would realize that the little white dots that were showing were just wrong, and she'd paint it over black and start again. And I was thinking, who decided she's an artist? I mean, okay, we'll call her an artist and shake her hand and give her a chance to hang the stuff she's finished with. But, you know, is there really any kind of process that she's engaged in that has anything to do with why we are talking about today? And then the extreme.
I won't even go into her because she's a unique case in
but
the
art world. But then there are these people who are doing things that, you know, you look at it and you say, what's that? And the answer is a five-page essay that you need to read. And that's their statement. And it's an art, a form of art that, although it's still hung in a museum and we still talk about it like it's, you know, graphic art, it really isn't. It's a mixed medium, and one of the mediums is writing. And you have to read the thing, and you have to know why he did it, and you have to know what he was thinking about, because otherwise it's trivial. And with that knowledge, it becomes, you know, important in some way, or at least it has some depth to it, and it isn't trivial. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that isn't art. I wouldn't dare to say anything isn't art. But I do think that, you know, in this sort of art in America context, you see an awful lot of stuff that needs to be hyped. And that dimension of hype just, you know, is the artist really part of that? If he is, then that's part of his art. But if he's just hyping because they told him he had to, you know, maybe he should just go back to what he was doing.
Yeah, well, I would like to jump back in context of what you said to what Donna was saying. In 4 minutes, you have chosen to really not set yourself in the middle of the forest of the contemporary art scene, and in so doing, those that you refer to are those that time has weeded up, weeded out the others, time has shown these to be those who were following a direction and getting somewhere. And I, at one point in my career, left off this concern with art form and art, the New York art scene and the contemporary art scene, and said, this is a dead end, very much this kind of way you're talking. And then I went back and I thought, what I need to do is focus on the high points of art history from day one that we can find in art history books and see what are those characteristics of the finest art that's ever been made. Yeah. And I found that that's the place I want to go. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And they all had, if you could distinguish the greats from other things happening around them, there was one, and what stirs my heart and soul, there were qualities about each of the high points that were similar. It's like each of these people had, through their simple, straightforward, one-pointed trying to go for something, had gotten somewhere, and that place was of a higher, more elevated view of the world from their point of view. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the looking around, and this is that influence of others we're talking about. If you start to be influenced by the others around you in the contemporary art world, you realize you cannot see the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. And you can't really know very well what's good and what's not good. And so you have to do some kind of like a check, like I did.
Yeah, well, you have to be not so much looking at what's good and not good as looking at what inspires you and what doesn't inspire you. And then be very judicious about what size dosage of influence is useful for your creative process.
And it feeds back and forth, because all of these great artists were not isolated. They were influenced by each other.
They were influenced
by other periods of art history. They were influenced by the places they traveled, like Matisse going to Morocco and creating this amazing body of work that then influenced other artists. And so we feed, you know, it's not a linear process at all. It's completely going all over the place. And I think you're right, Alan, that you always have to just go back and tune in to what helps me.
Yeah. When I discovered that there were literally hundreds and, of course, probably thousands of other people doing music superficially similar to what I'm doing, let's say in the same genre, my first thought was, I want to go see what they're all doing. And then as I started exploring it, I saw that, a lot of what they're doing I don't care for. And I finally just ended up on the idea that I think it's fantastic. I didn't have any idea there were that many people interested in the kind of thing that I'm doing, whether I'm listening to them or not. And so I was inspired by the existence of other people in this field, but I didn't feel any competition from them.
Great.
It's a wrap.
I think that wraps up today's show.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.